Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Weeks ago today, President Bush's Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, failed to be funny.
Good afternoon, everyone, and I hope you all had an enjoyable weekend.
Paulson was greeting us after the weekend that the banking system fell apart. By a few weeks later, he was telling Congress it was no joke.
We have an archaic financial regulatory structure that came in place a long time ago after the Depression. It really needs to be rebuilt.
Bush administration cabinet officials for rebuilding the regulatory structure. Well, yes, that was Henry Paulson from a year ago. And what has changed in that year since the panic began on Wall Street? Well, not enough for President Obama, who, as you've been hearing, will give a kind of Lehman anniversary speech in Lower Manhattan today. And not enough for my first guest, New York Times business columnist Gretchen Morgenson, who keeps her jaundiced eye on the masters of the financial universe. She is also editor of a new book called The Capitalist's Bible. Hi, Gretchen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. Glad to be back.
And I want to begin not with Lehman Brothers, but with Bernie Madoff. Here is
okay.
An extraordinary recording of Madoff just released last week by the state of Massachusetts. It's 2005. He's talking on the phone to someone from one of his feeder funds and does not appear to know he's being recorded. Now listen to how he dismisses the effectiveness of the SEC regulators who sometimes come to check his books.
You know, we run through this all the time. The guys come in to do a books and records examination, and they ask you a zillion different questions, and we look at them sometimes and we laugh, and we say, are you guys writing a book? These guys, they work for 5 years at the commission, then they become a compliance manager at a hedge fund now,
right.
Or they go work for a proprietary trading desk. Nobody wants to stay there forever.
Bernie Madoff, and again, that was just released last week. That was from 2005. Gretchen Morgenson, had you heard that before just now?
I had not, but he certainly is, I would say, the world's leading authority on how the SEC does not do its job.
And I'm sure it applies to legal businesses as well as illegal ones. And that part at the end about how the regulators are mostly young, they work for the SEC for 5 years with a career goal of going to work for one of the hedge funds that they're regulating, so how tough are they going to be? Is that really
exactly
the way that is the way it works?
Well, that is the way it works, not just at the SEC, unfortunately, but at far too many government agencies. I think that, you know, obviously the salaries there are very, very low, and everyone has sort of an eye on the prize that will come later if they are able to get a job, you know, on Wall Street or at a major bank. And so, yeah, there is a revolving door. It's a big problem. But there are other problems as well, Brian. I think that it's just a mindset that we had, which was that these people did not have an appetite to regulate. We don't really need new regulations, I don't believe. We do need regulators that really want to do their jobs.
Will President Obama address that in his speech today or in policy recommendations?
Well, I'm sure that he will, because this is has been an enormous breakdown. And whenever I write about regulatory failures, I get an awful lot of emails from people who say, you know, right on, this is something. And these people are rewarded with even more authority and more power and bigger jobs. And there's just something really radically wrong with that.
Your column yesterday was titled, "But Who is Watching Regulators?" And one of your main points was just that. You see the government awarding even more power to the same people who failed in their oversight. Be specific, Gretchen. Who are some of those people and how did they fail?
Well, the Federal Reserve Board, for instance, which is the top regulator, certainly the most prestigious regulator in this country as far as financial regulators are concerned, and, you know, had as its charge safety and soundness of the banking business. And, of course, we had unsafety and unsoundness that brought us to the brink and really devastated our economy. So it was really the Federal Reserve Board's watch, and it was really their failure. Well, now they are asking Ben Bernanke and, you know, his cohorts are asking for more power for the Federal Reserve to become sort of the systemic risk regulator, or the regulator above all others, who will, now they tell us, you know, we'll be able to see problems on the horizon before they blow up the system. Well, I, for one, am doubtful.
Listeners, who should watch the regulators? How should the system be reinvented? 212-433-WNYC for Gretchen Morgenson this morning, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You know, there are free marketeers who argue exactly the opposite, that the government is risking more crashes like last year's precisely because they are regulating more and bailing out so much. From our webpage right now, capitalism and democracy are not dead despite the illegal actions of Obama and the Fed to take over the banks, auto manufacturing, the healthcare industry, and other sectors of the economy. Someone else just posted, the left's gleeful renewed attack on capitalism and its inherent individual liberties and personal freedoms brings to mind Tocqueville's observation that some Americans, quote, are so enamored of equality that they would rather be equal in poverty than be unequal in freedom. And, you know, those folks would say, look, let the market work, lightly regulated. Let companies fail if they fail. That'll ultimately mean more jobs, more growth, more freedom, quicker regeneration. Do you buy it at all?
Well, what we have really, Brian, is the worst of both worlds now. We have, and I certainly wouldn't equate regulation with bailouts. Okay, those are two separate things. If people had been alert to the incredibly reckless practices that were going on at some of these banks and had shut them down, then we would not have needed these bailouts, or certainly not the amount of money that we've thrown at this problem. So I think that one thing, you know, they're not the same thing, both those two items. So if you do have a balance. I mean, my feeling is we had a two-pronged failure here. We had a failure of executives at large, prestigious and trusted corporations who failed to rein in reckless practices, failed to rein in greed and sort of the human nature of grabbing for the gusto. That was the first failure. The second failure was the regulatory failure, in which the people charged with overseeing these practices did nothing when they were really a race to the bottom and put the taxpayer at such risk. So that is my explanation for it. I do not think we can have a type of capitalism, as we have just witnessed, with light regulation. I do believe we need to have rules because, as we just saw in this very damaging episode, even the most trusted corporations were not trustworthy enough to rein in these terrible practices.
David in Manhattan has an idea. Hi, David. You're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. I, as a former trader and someone who's got a lot of friends in the business, the glaring sort of problem that I see is the fact that bonuses are paid out in lump sum at 1 year at a time based on the performance of the previous year. They're highly discretionary, and I think that one of the first things they can do is to change that payout structure so that bonuses are paid in increments over a period of years, and that in order to collect the full bonus for a year's work, you know, a trader has to show that they traded with some sort of long-range perspective and responsibility, and that there should be audits as well periodically of those payouts before the payouts are made in full.
David, take me one step further into that as a former trader. If a banker or an investor has an incentive to make money now because they'll get a bigger bonus now if they do so, how does that pervert the system? Why does that make things go bad in the long run if they succeed in making more money today?
I think that the recent events are a perfect example of why and how. And, you know, it's a cascading effect. But if at each trade a banker or a trader is aware that they're going to be potentially held accountable, just like today when you file your annual tax return, there's a possibility that you may get audited. I think it'll make them think twice about how highly they leverage their portfolios and what kind of instruments they recommend to their customers, like the CDOs that were being traded like wildfire leading up to this crisis.
David, thank you very much. Any other former traders out there? Anybody who's ever worked for the SEC? Were your heads nodding when you heard that Bernie Madoff clip? Maybe you're one of those people who was a regulator for 5 years, then went to work for a hedge fund that you were regulating, which was your real goal. Anybody want to cop to that? Or anyone else? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. A lot of interesting stuff coming up there, too, and we'll quote some more from it in a minute for Gretchen Morgenson, New York Times business columnist. Gretchen, do you want to react to David's story and his suggestion?
He couldn't be more correct, I think. I mean, it really has been a failure to look at the long term. There's a short-termism on Wall Street that dominates, and it, you know, begins with the analysts who look to companies to meet the quarterly number every quarter, and if they don't, you know, they're punished. The stocks, you know, get pummeled. So, you know, it's everywhere, this short-term mentality, and it is extremely damaging because what it does is it incentivizes people to, you know, take a big gamble, take a big risk, get the payout, and then waltz out the door, leaving the problems for now the taxpayers.
And
he's absolutely right.
This always comes up, but is there a way, is there any model from recent history of companies structuring bonuses on the basis of performance over 2 years, over 3 years, rather than quarterly or 1 year?
Well, there are some companies out there, I believe, that do that in that they require that their executives take their payouts over longer periods of time. I think that this is an idea that's gaining in popularity with the obvious failures that we've seen, certainly at companies like Merrill Lynch and, you know, the other Wall Street firms. So, yeah, I think you'll see more of it. It certainly is not going to answer the entire problem or solve the entire problem, but at least it will focus on this problem of, you know, hurry, let's grab the most money I can now before the house of cards collapses.
Your book is called The Capitalist Bible. I always thought Atlas Shrugged was the Capitalist Bible. But you begin with a story of a friend of yours who lost his job a few years ago. Want to tell the story?
This was a person who, you know, like so many people, had been downsized. And, you know, he was sending out the resume, struggling, trying to figure out how to kind of make lemonade out of the lemons he had. And he received a phone call from a bank selling a credit line for him. He said, look, we can give you a $150,000 credit line on your home. And, you know, my friend was sort of shocked by this. It was something that he didn't even had not thought of as a solution to his problem. And he said, look, I'm out of work. How could I possibly, you know, take that loan? And how would I qualify? And the salesperson said, no problem. We really don't need any income verification or job verification. You can just apply and the money's yours. Well, this is absolutely example of what went on to a fare-thee-well during the mortgage mania. People were just throwing money at anybody with a pulse. And while my friend turned it down because he was very concerned about the long-term, you know,
impact
his
on
long-term
him.
Ability to pay it back,
yeah.
You know, there were many people who did not, who just, you know, said, okay, wow, look at this. You know, banks used to be very prudent in their lending. Well, that went right out the window.
And does that story at ground level with this one guy and his mortgage offer relate back to David's story about, you know, the mucky mucks and their bonuses?
Yes, it does, and I'll tell you why. Because in the mania, we had a complete breakdown of due diligence. There was absolutely no incentive to be prudent about the lending because all these mortgage lenders were doing was trying to make loans that they could then sell downstream to investors. And if the loan failed, it would then become someone else's problem, not theirs. And so, again, the incentives were completely wrong. And so you had this situation where the people making the loans sold the loans and had no care at all as to whether they would perform over the long term. They just got their commission, and that generated a bonus.
And are the rules different today? I gather not from your writing and from the lead story in the Times on Saturday about how little has changed in the regulatory structure with respect to all these derivatives.
What has changed, Brian, is the appetite for this kind of risky lending. It has completely, you know, disappeared because everybody is licking their wounds. I mean, we've got government intervention in the financial system like never before.
But why isn't that an argument on the free marketeer side? Because they'll say, well, look, after the bubble bursts, capitalists, ordinary people, learn their lessons, and then they don't do these kinds of excessive things again. You don't need the government coming in and placing a new regulatory burden on everybody and telling them they can't do what they now know doesn't work, because that's going to squeeze other kinds of innovation.
The only problem with that argument is, of course, that the taxpayer is now on the hook for trillions of dollars of losses. So, you know, if the taxpayer was not on the hook, then yeah, maybe you could make that case. But I'm sorry, they have now privatized gains and socialized the losses that were, you know, generated by this reckless lending and these terrible practices.
Gretchen Morgenson, New York Times business columnist, my guest on WNYC, and editor of a new book called The Capitalist's Bible. And here is a venture capitalist, so he says, Mike in Manhattan. Mike, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hi, am I on?
Yes.
Okay, I actually have an example that I think works pretty well. I'm at Columbia, and I work as a venture capitalist. When we sell our stock at an IPO, and I'm going to simplify the rules because they're a little complicated, but basically we cannot sell our shares at the same time. A different agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has what they call Rule 144, which is a lockup, and it means that we cannot sell our stock until the stock has been out and circulated and traded. And the marketplace has a chance to determine that the price is proper, and it moves up and down and then basically settles down. And then there's a graded period that can be as short as 6 months and as long as several years, and we can get out then. The same thing could be done with securities and with loans. That is, you don't get your commission on the front, but you see how many of those loans go bad. This is hardly original with me. Two very respected people, Nicholas Nassim Taleb and Luigi Zingales, have been suggesting this for years. And I'll take yours and Ms. Morganson's reply off the air.
Mike,
thank
let me
you.
Ask you one, if you're still there, ask you one follow-up question.
Sure.
You're a venture capitalist based at Columbia University at the school?
No, both as an academic and as a member of a venture capital firm.
I see. You're not investing their endowment.
No, we would have done much better if I had been.
Thank you very much. And all those students seeking financial aid might have been the better for it. But Gretchen, that sounds like an interesting model. It responds to the previous caller. It's a way of delaying the rewards for the people issuing the stock until they can see performance over a period of time.
Well, I certainly think that one has to go back and look at the long-term performance of the loans that were made. I mean, in the old days, before the securitization of mortgages really took over this whole business, you know, if you were a banker and you made a lot of loans that went bad, chances are you were going to be fired from your job. You certainly weren't going to be getting a promotion to bank president. So, yes, you know, that would be a way to, you know, get back to the due diligence, the type of due diligence that was done in the old days when it was very quaint to know your banker and the banker knew you, and then the banker was on the hook if the loan went bad. I agree with him. I think that would be a kind of lockup would be very useful.
You admit in the preface to the book that you had to go through some late editing because you had originally included companies like Citigroup and AIG in your chapter on capitalism success stories. That makes it all sound like playing the slots in Vegas rather than anything as rational as Ayn Rand might have it.
Well, I'll tell you, we have just been through an enormous upheaval. I mean, I don't need to tell you. You've been watching it as closely as I have. But, you know, Citibank was in by various measures, Citigroup was by various measures the largest financial institution out there. And, you know, for it to then become a ward of the state, which is, you know, one-third owned by the taxpayers in, you know, little more than 2 years, is really, really unbelievable. Now, you know that Joseph Schumpeter called this creative destruction,
mm-hmm,
right?
Right.
And boy, I'll tell you, the destruction didn't feel too good while it was going on for the shareholders and the other stakeholders. But, you know, that certainly was an example, as was AIG. I mean, the velocity with which these companies went off a cliff was just unbelievable.
From our webpage, Robert writes, we all admitted to the failure of communism 20 years ago, So why do we, in quotes, so resist to admit the failure of American capitalism? It failed, and it's time to get on with getting a system in place that works for everyone. Is that too global a comment for you?
Well, I certainly think that this has been, I would say, utter failure. I don't think anybody can call this period a period of success. I mean, there were some shining lights, some people who were trying to, you know, get the word out that this was, these practices were going on, jumping up and down in the back of the room. Nobody was paying attention to them. It was just the money was too great and the upside was too phenomenal. I think that what we have to look at now is very much this too big to fail idea that companies are allowed to grow so large that they can threaten the entire world economy. That has to be addressed. And it really, Brian, has not been addressed at all in any of the discussions that we've had. I mean, all we have is now the Fed wanting to be the systemic risk regulator and have some way to try to unwind a big firm. But how about just starting to make sure that these companies cannot get so big that they would threaten us all?
Is it because democracy, at least our democracy, is not strong enough to stand up to the capitalist elite because they're going to Washington? Washington Post had an interesting story yesterday. Maybe you saw it. Headline in shift, Wall Street goes to Washington, and it's about all the new money that the big investment houses and others are spending on lobbying, as if they weren't spending a lot before. But because the taxpayers now have so much skin in the game and Washington is so bent on trying to do something. But is that the problem? Is democracy just too weak for is American democracy too weak for American capitalism?
I think that we are all very weak. We are weakened when stock prices are going up. We are lulled into complacency when everything seems to be rosy. There don't seem to be any problems. You can go get a loan. You can buy an even bigger house. You can borrow more money on your credit card so that you can take an even greater vacation. Don't you think that that lulls everybody into many people into a kind of a complacency that is exceedingly dangerous? I mean, I do. I feel that it's not just the leaders of these companies and our regulatory leaders. We all sort of got taken in by this idea that we could have a bigger home and afford it. We could, you know, take the wonderful vacations on the credit card. I mean, it was almost a drug-induced stupor, I would say, and it was a credit binge. And now we're having to unravel all of that.
You know, on too big to fail, it's easy to say we shouldn't have any company that's too big to fail. We certainly get callers and posters to our website on that all the time, and you were saying it. But, you know, other people involved in the business look at it differently. Tim Geithner, I have heard, the Treasury Secretary, prefers to say too interconnected mm-hmm. to fail. Mm-hmm. We had the chairman of Citigroup in recently, Richard Parsons. And he was saying, you know, you may not like the idea of companies that are too big to fail because they get rich and then the taxpayers sometimes are on the hook to bail them out. But if America is going to be a leader in the world economy, everything is so interconnected that you have to have some institutions that are that big. Do you disagree?
I disagree completely. I think that Paul Volcker, who is an incredible public servant, he was the Federal Reserve Board chairman during a very, very difficult time in the early 80s. He has discussed plans and his ideas about how to break up these monolithic companies into smaller entities that do not have the same kind of, you know, vertical integration of all their operations. I mean, we did have Glass-Steagall, which came out of the 1930s when we had the terrible crash and found that all of these similar practices were going on, where there were conflicts of interest throughout a company's operation because they had so many different types of units. But, you know, that fell down, that fell by the wayside. And, you know, I think what Mr. Volcker is advocating is some way to kind of break up these big, huge companies. You can have smaller companies who do the same thing and do it well and compete. You don't have to have, they don't have to be these kinds of giants that are then, when things go wrong, imperiling the entire world economy.
Gretchen Morgenson, New York Times business columnist and editor of a new book called The Capitalist's Bible. Maybe it's the New Testament for capitalists, and Amen was the Old Testament. I don't know. But Gretchen, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brian, anytime.
And we will be talking about this all week. Tomorrow, we'll look at who's been left behind in the bailout largesse, and it is still homeowners facing foreclosure. Coming up in a minute, tires versus chicken parts in a new trading war between China and the United States. We'll look at that business story. Stay with us.